That means Angela Merkel's era comes to an end as Germany's parliament elects Social Democrat Olaf Scholz as the new chancellor. Australia joins the U.S. in a diplomatic boycott of the Winter Games in Beijing. China's reaction to the move coming up. Plus, protests in Peru turn violent as the Congress turns down a motion to impeach President Castillo. Hello and welcome, everyone. Our top story for this half hour: Germany now has a new chancellor. The low house of the parliament has just formally elected Olaf Scholz as the country's new leader, putting an end to Angela Merkel's long reign. Scholz got a clear majority of almost 400 votes in the chamber that has over 730 seats. He will later meet the German president for nomination as chancellor before returning to the parliament to take his oath of office. Scholz is a center-left social democrat leading a three-party coalition with the Greens and the Liberal Free Democrats. He's been serving as Merkel's finance minister since 2018 and has pledged to continue her policies to make Germany fairer and greener. Merkel is the first German chancellor to step down of her own accord since World War II. Jerome Hughes joins us now from Brussels. Jerome, they're calling it the dawn of a new era for Germany. What can you tell us about the legacy of the outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel, not just for Germany, but for Europe as well?
That's right, Bardia. Well, as you say, the dawn of a new era, but the end of an era as well in terms of politics in Germany and for the European Union as well, because Angela Merkel was seen as the glue that held the European Union together, even though she wasn't able to prevent the partial breakup of the European Union in the form of Brexit, which of course was the worst moment politically for the European Union since its foundation. But as in the intervening period since Brexit, she has been very much in the background at the European Commission and at the negotiations to try and make it look as difficult as possible for a country to leave the EU, thereby dissuading other countries from following suit. So in that respect, she's also had a role in trying to keep the European Union together. But it ends a very long political career, 31 years in politics and 16 years in the top job. And I think now Scholz is seen as a safe pair of hands from the EU's perspective, because he would certainly be in the same mold as Angela Merkel. The question, though, of course, is, you know, we've seen in history, it's a big jump from being, say, finance minister or foreign affairs minister to taking the top job as the prime minister or as the chancellor. And so, you know, will the transition go well? Will he be up for the job? All these questions remain to be answered. But Angela Merkel, I mean, in terms of her legacy, we had the 2008-2009 financial crisis. Germany's influence under her guidance managed to keep Greece in the Eurozone, in the EU. That would have been a devastating impact if Greece had fallen out of the EU. And then, of course, later on, we would have had Brexit. But also, I think her strongest legacy will be taking in more than 1 million refugees in 2015 and 2016, which was very, very unpopular. But actually, you know, as years go by, perhaps in another decade or so, people will look back and say that really, against all the odds and against all the political backlash, she did the right thing on a humanitarian level. And not only did she take in all of these refugees, but it took the political pressure off the other countries, because they were facing massive political backlash in terms of taking in refugees. So she alleviated that somewhat. And now she supported anti-migrant policies since then, so that we've had very much closed borders in the EU. And again, that has alleviated somewhat the political pressure. Of course, as well, I mean, the financial situation, Germany is the powerhouse behind the European Union. And so it has always been such a key player. Of course, we hear so much about the European Commission. It's the executive arm. It formulates policies. But always in the background, we've had Angela Merkel, you know, basically forming policies, helping to form policies and so on. Because without Germany and France and Italy, without those countries giving the green light to these major policies that we hear announced by the European Commission, You know, they would never be announced. But basically, they're more or less rubber stamped by these big countries in the background before they're officially unveiled. Otherwise, it would be a calamity. It would be chaos because the policies would be unveiled and then they'd be rejected. So Merkel has had a major role on a whole range of fronts. And now, of course, her successor will have to deal with the pandemic, will have to deal with the energy crisis, will have to deal with the rise of the far right, because we're seeing Euroscepticism rise. We have candidates in the elections in France that could do very well, which would be a big blow to the European Union if we have sort of candidates getting into governments like in France, where it would go against so-called EU values and against the grain of the European Union policies. So, you know, he has a big job on his hands. And again, it remains to be seen whether he's up for the job.
All right, thanks a lot. Jerome Hughes joining us from Brussels. Elsewhere, European Union health ministers meet in Brussels to discuss rising COVID-19 cases and growing pressure on the bloc's health services. Vaccine hesitancy is being singled out as the driving force behind hospital admissions, deaths, and new restrictions. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Figures have just emerged which show that less than 55% of the population in six EU nations have received a COVID-19 vaccine, despite plenty being available. Experts say vaccine hesitancy is the main reason behind rising coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, deaths, and the reintroduction of restrictive measures across the 27-country bloc. EU health ministers have been meeting in Brussels to take stock of the crisis.
So is this not a massive failure from the EU? Should the EU not be putting much more of its effort into trying to convince people to take the vaccines?
The EU citizens have moved forward, and we have over 66% of the total population vaccinated and 77% of the adult. But we mustn't stop.
Growing pressure on hospitals means that non-COVID patients are being neglected, and those without private health insurance are falling between the cracks.
Our member organisations are reporting on a daily basis of some of the barriers to access to healthcare, increasing co-payments, difficulties in accessing medicines, specialists, etc. This simply cannot go on.
As EU health ministers met on Tuesday, so too did the bloc's finance ministers. The message was both old and new risks to the EU economy are materialising.
Notably, the growing case numbers and reintroduction of restrictions, global supply chains, and the rise of inflation.
Bulgaria and Romania stand out as having the lowest vaccination rates in the EU. Fears over new variants have been heightened by the Omicron mutation. At the start of the pandemic, EU nations closed their borders and turned their backs on Italy, which was buckling under the pressure. It was left to Russia to fly in emergency medical supplies. It's a story the bloc's leaders never talk about. In a veiled reference to it here, health ministers say there must be better cooperation between member states when the next crisis emerges. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
South Korea is reporting yet another record high in the number of daily COVID infections for the third consecutive week. There have been more than 7,000 daily infections in one day, putting hospitals under a lot of strain. Authorities are struggling to secure enough beds for patients. The government is also mobilizing additional personnel to oversee patients who are treating themselves at home. Deaths and severe cases are also on a rising trend. The Southeast Asian country that is praised for its success in containing the pandemic lifted distancing rules and reopened businesses last month. Nearly 92% of the population is now fully vaccinated. And Australia joins the U.S. in diplomatically boycotting the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says government officials will not accompany Australian athletes in the upcoming games. He says China has failed to respond to several issues raised by Canberra, including alleged human rights abuses. A day earlier, Washington also announced a diplomatic boycott of the Winter Olympics, citing a similar pretext. The decision angered China, which warned that the U.S. will pay a price for its mistakes. Beijing says the United States is planning to disrupt the international event, but will fail. In Peru, a failed attempt in the parliament to impeach President Pedro Castillo draws thousands, including both his supporters and opponents, to the streets. And the rival protests ended in scuffles with security forces. The president's opponents gathered outside the parliament building holding banners and calling for the closure of the Congress after it voted against the impeachment. The president's supporters, on the other hand, chanted slogans calling for the leftist leader to stay in power. Castillo's presidency was challenged by the opposition 2 weeks ago over alleged meddling in military promotions. He's also accused of corruption. The president took office 4 months ago, but his presidency has been marred by fraud ever since. Iran warns the United States that imposing more sanctions won't create any leverage in the Vienna talks. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says such moves show anything but seriousness and goodwill. He noted that Washington's so-called maximum pressure policy against Tehran runs contrary to any diplomatic breakthrough. The comments come after the U.S. Treasury Department announced fresh sanctions on a number of Iranian entities and nationals over alleged human rights violations. Tehran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have so far held 7 rounds of talks in Vienna with the aim of removing anti-Iran sanctions. The latest round of negotiations is now in recess and will resume on Thursday. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says that the U.S. must remove all of its sanctions if it wishes to return to the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA. In an opinion piece in the Russian daily Kommersant, Amir Abdullahian noted that Iran continued to fully comply by JCPOA even a year after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal. He says his country was hoping for effective measures from the 3 European signatories, namely Britain, France, and Germany, but they failed to take the right standpoint. Iran's top diplomat says Tehran will only return to full compliance of the 2015 nuclear deal if the U.S. guarantees that the past won't repeat itself. He insists that Iran will not accept anything beyond the JCPOA and the negotiations cannot go on forever. The U.S. Senate rejects a resolution that sought to block the Biden administration's $650 million arms deal with Saudi Arabia. Senators have voted down the resolution by 67 votes against 30. That means the government can now freely move on with these sales. It includes 280 advanced missiles, among other equipment. The bill was sponsored by Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders and 2 Republican senators. Sanders believes that exporting more missiles to Saudi Arabia will only fuel the war against Yemen, but opponents argue that the U.S. needs to show its commitment to its security partners. The State Department notified the Congress of the deal last month. It offers massive military support to Saudi Arabia just as the country is escalating attacks on Yemen, despite campaign promises by President Joe Biden to end the bloody war. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit the global economy hard over the past 2 years, but a new report suggests that the arms industry is thriving like never before. The expansion of the multi-billion dollar sector comes as governments are increasing their military spending. But where are all those arms going to be used? Are there new conflicts on the horizon?
The COVID-19 pandemic prompted lengthy lockdowns and disrupted supply chains, negatively impacting the global economic growth. But one sector has been immune to the effects of the virus, the arms industry. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, the world's top 100 arms manufacturers sold a record $531 billion worth of weapons and military services last year. That figure is up by 1.3% compared to the year before. The Swedish think tank says 2020 was the 6th consecutive year in which global arms sales grew. Compared to 2015, overall sales were 17% higher in 2020. The Institute explains that the government's higher demand for arms has been behind the growth in sales, which protected the industry giants from potential slumps.
I think the problem is that these weapons companies have created such powerful lobbies, and they go around the world trying to sell their weapons, oftentimes to very undemocratic governments that use these weapons to hold on to their power. So it's only a small sector of the global economy that benefits from the weapon sales. The problem is they are just too powerful, and the alliance that they make with autocratic governments gives them even more power.
According to the report, Asian countries are becoming increasingly important, as 3 of the 100 firms were Indian, whose sales amounted to 1.2% of the world's total, on par with South Korea. Chinese firms also sold $67 billion worth of arms last year, up by 1.5% compared to 2019.
The United States retains its position as the world's number one arms producer, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. American firms accounted for 54% of the overall sales in 2020, and their targets are often countries in West Asia with questionable human rights records.
American firms constituted 41 out of 100 top arms producers, selling over $285 billion worth of arms and military equipment. That's more than Finland's annual gross domestic product. The top five manufacturers are all from the United States, including Lockheed Martin, which ranks first.
And it is very unfortunate that U.S. companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Boeing, General Dynamics, they are among the top weapons companies in the world, and they have tremendous power in the United States and globally to keep benefiting from death and destruction. And I think instead of weapons companies, we should refer them to them as the merchants of death, for indeed that is what they are, and what they do is sell death and destruction.
Britain's BAE Systems is in the sixth position and is the highest placed European firm, just ahead of three Chinese groups. Saudi Arabia is one of the world's top arms importers. The manufacturers are providing Riyadh with billions of dollars of weapons and equipment despite the kingdom's years-long war on Yemen, the conflict that has resulted in the death of thousands and created what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Earlier this month, France signed a $19 billion arms deal with the United Arab Emirates, under which Abu Dhabi will acquire 80 Rafale fighter jets and 12 military helicopters. Rights groups have condemned the deal and urged Paris to stop the weapons sales, citing the UAE's involvement in the war on Yemen.
Certainly the possibility of conflict is something that fuels the arms industry, and so it's in their benefit to see conflicts continue, to drum up new conflicts, to heat up the Cold War, for example, between the U.S. and China, the U.S. and Russia. Its business is selling weapons, and so it needs conflict.
The growing trend in global arms sales is particularly concerning, as they need to be used somewhere. Considering the heightened tensions worldwide between major powers, if the trend continues, the world will turn into a tinderbox.
That's a wrap for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
miles off.
Historically, universities were created to satisfy a thirst for knowledge. All over the world, rulers established knowledge academies for society to benefit from scholarly expertise generated in these institutions. And now, universities have an innate for discovery. Their professors write leading research, and their scientific breakthroughs have revolutionized industries. Universities have contributed to health and medicine, which has sometimes literally stopped epidemics and saved lives. With this in mind, and universities would make for excellent...
Welcome to another edition of Supports the Development of... See why research is so important in the growth of industries. Stay with us as we uncover how the higher education system is contributing to the expansion of the national economy. Time to check out today's Bazaar.
To get more insight on how universities support development of technology, we visited one in the capital city, Tehran. Islamic Azad University, Northern Tehran Unit, has been around for decades. Each year, some 40,000 students matriculate in bachelor's, master's, and PhD programs. Academia shares the entrepreneurial drive for discovery and innovation. So, this university adopted a program for the development of technology and engineering, which is called the Roche Center. It is a growth center that manages and operates dozens of academic incubators. The program not only supports student innovation and entrepreneurship, but also provides services to knowledge-based companies for research and development. This platform receives support and oversight from the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology and the National Innovation Fund. The main goal in developing this program is to find technological solutions for various needs of the country. For example, the outcome of a research project conducted here was the formulation of a medicine used to treat COVID-19 infections. There are 40 core projects currently in incubation here, and the center has collaborations in many fields of the industry. It is able to stay present in innovative technology arenas by directly using academic research and potentials of its students.
Now, the advantage of growth programs, such as the one we just mentioned, is that it creates a network between students, research and knowledge-based firms. Most essentially, it joins the puzzle pieces of knowledge, tools and funds together needed for manufacturing innovative products. This helps create new and advanced products that might not exist in the market or need to be further developed for industries.
The center offers important facilities for scientific studies. It houses a large and highly equipped laboratory complex for advanced research. The lab provides services and equipment to 6 departments at the university, such as biochemistry and biology. The lab complex has many functions. One is to provide research facilities to students in master's and PhD programs in various sciences. Here, students who have graduated are also employed to conduct research brought in from outside knowledge-based companies. The other function of the lab is to provide a constructive link between university research and industries. For example, knowledge-based companies that produce pharmaceuticals can conduct their research and development at the highly equipped workshops. Research at this lab has helped companies produce many vital products that were previously imported. It might be interesting to know that researchers here adhere to strict national and international standards for product quality and safety. This is a critical step for startups or knowledge-based companies who want to commercialize products they have developed. This center was developed in response to the US sanctions. It has manufactured several products and advanced technology to satisfy the needs of Iranians during the period of sanctions. Some of these products are widely used in the medical sector.
E Each university in the country has a growth program that supports the entrepreneurship and innovation of students and some businesses. These centers transform creativity and scientific research into products available in the market. In a nutshell, academic incubators are one of the tools used for economic growth. So, what is the government doing to strengthen research and expand the knowledge-based economy?
In 2016, Iran had 5 times more higher education centers than most developed countries in the world. At that time, there were some 2,640 higher education centers combined. By comparison, this number was just 40 units less than China, which is the most populous country in the world. That's all according to the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology. The ministry began implementing a nationwide plan to reorganize and aggregate higher education centers last year. Under this plan, small-scale academic establishments are aggregated into a network and operated under the auspices of major universities. This saves the country millions of dollars, and educational institutions are able to share financial and educational resources. This scheme carries many benefits. First, it helps academic institutions increase the quality of education and expand the reach of academic incubators. And second, it helps the government and higher education centers efficiently allocate funds and resources to develop focused programs for research. R&D funding is also an investment in regional innovation ecosystems that leads to advanced technology production needed in industries. There are around 3.5 million students in Iran, and increasing the number of graduates has an overall positive effect on high-tech employment in the long run.
Universities play an important role in determining a region's capacity for innovation and transforming new ideas into economic activity. They educate the local workforce, which creates human capital and produces intellectual property. Universities also indirectly contribute through their research activities, which other businesses can use to make commercial value. These foundational research activities help create and advance industries in many ways.
For example, the medical sector is one that has greatly benefited from advanced technology developed by universities and research-based firms. 56% of medical equipment available in the world market in 2018 had Iranian versions. That was based on figures from the National Medical Device Directorate. Some of these items were also on the US sanctions list. These products were developed domestically and produced along the lines of international standards, allowing them to compete in markets abroad. Another advantage of indigenizing advanced medical equipment was reducing costs and dependence on imports. Based on the National Medical Device Directorate, Iran currently exports its medical products to 54 countries across the world. In 2018, the domestic market for these items was estimated to be worth nearly $3 billion.
For millennia, Iranian scholars have actively contributed to advancing knowledge in science and technology. And today, Iran is part of the fast pace at which technological innovation is developing using knowledge-based research. Energy-efficient light bulbs or COVID-19 testing kits are just some of the knowledge-based products that you might be familiar with. Iranian knowledge-based companies have brought many social and economic advantages for people and generating billions of dollars in revenues from its product.
We wanted to see how an idea can be transformed into a marketable specialized product and how we'll uncover how they have contributed to the economy. Enough said, let's walk through today's Bazaar.
Our journey began at a company that works closely with the Islamic Azad University of Iran. Virajin Akam was first established in 2008 and specializes in making technology for analyzing genes and viruses. Its main products are panel H kits and devices used in medical laboratories. Currently, it has commercialized two of its products for virus detection tests. As part of its vision for the future, this knowledge-based company is looking to expand its product list to include molecular analysis kits for cancer cells. The production unit incorporates the latest technology while including the highest quality of raw material. This company uses in-depth scientific research and know-how, which is carried out by expert staff to manufacture its high-tech products. It has received its production licenses from the Ministry of Health and Medical Education and obtained international standardization certifications too. This means its products, while matching national standards, also adhere to international regulations, allowing them to easily compete in global markets. This company produces 20 different types of kits and a variety of diagnostic kits as well. The production facilities are capable of producing thousands of testing kits per week. There are numerous opportunities for investment in such a company, particularly as it is already standing on the threshold of exporting its products.
As you might know, medical testing kits are very sensitive items which need to be dependable and accurate. Their continuous accuracy is the most important aspect of their use. A lot of science and research goes into making these products, which are the tools doctors use to help patients. For this reason, quality assurance is key in being able to market these items.
The heart of this company is its highly equipped quality control division. Here, all products are tested for performance and accuracy in each stage of production. This includes testing the raw material used to make these kits. This department is essential for maintaining quality and manufacturing items with zero failure rates. But that's not all. The quality control unit is also home to the research and development department. One of the activities at this department is to reverse engineer certain items, such as kits used for the study of genetics, which are currently imported. One of the competitive advantages of this company is that it manufactures medical devices that were previously imported. Indigenizing these items has saved the medical sector millions of dollars from capital flight. Another advantage of this knowledge-based company is its link to the Islamic Azad University's Technology Development Center, meaning the research and development division of this company is able to directly benefit from scientific advancements and services provided by the academic institution. This company has faced numerous challenges over the years, but its trump card has always been its uniquely progressive approach to development. The US sanctions have marginally impacted businesses in this field by hampering international money transfers. This knowledge-based company views the sanctions as an opportunity to strengthen productions, filling the market void while reducing the country's dependence on imports.
Research driven by scientific inquiry plays a significant role in product development. At its core, advanced technology is created by adding valuable features to items that have specialized uses. Academic and research institutions are the bridge between ideas and marketable products, and several universities across Iran are providing services to help support knowledge-based startups.
The company we discussed earlier is an example of a knowledge-based company that was born from the support of a growth program at the Islamic Azad University. The program is called Roshd Center, and its main activity is to incubate startups and entrepreneurship. The center is a platform that supports the creation and developments of new businesses in the field of advanced technology development as they start up. It provides services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully implement their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. These services include offering workspace facilities and managerial, technical, and legal consultations, Usually, startups are incubated at this center for around 3 to 5 years. These centers serve as a type of technical infrastructure and offer a framework for sustainable business growth. The incubators also pursue broader goals, such as regional economic growth, and diversify the economy and investors. It also provides assistance to women and society's minorities in their entrepreneurial endeavors. The advantage of a university incubator is its upfront link to live research and the most recent discoveries. It is a place where scientific advancement directly meets technology development. Azad universities have some 400 campuses nationwide and hundreds of thousands of students enrolling annually. Each campus is equipped with a Rosht Center. For example, the North Tehran unit has 22 projects currently incubating.
But universities aren't the only place where incubators are found. Science and technology parks are also another area that offer similar services to knowledge-based startup and technology-developing businesses. Many of their products are presently streamlined into the market and are also exported to destination markets abroad.
Tech parks are another place where advanced technology is developed for various industries. Based on figures from the Ministry of Research, Science and Technology, there are 42 tech parks and 186 incubators spread across the country. The number of knowledge-based companies has steadily increased over the years. If there were 50 high-tech firms in 2013, now there are 125 times more than that number in 2021. Right now, there are over 6,200 high-tech firms and knowledge-based companies nationwide. Many of these businesses are active in the field of information and communication technology, machinery equipment, and electronic products. Plus, a large number of the companies are actively producing medical devices and pharmaceuticals. Last year, tech and knowledge-based firms raked in over $5 billion in internal revenues. That's according to statistics from Iran's National Innovation Fund. The Science and Technology Office of the Vice Presidency estimates exports of these products will generate $1 billion in foreign revenues by the end of the year. High technology is a product of advancements in national academic and scientific research. And nearly 70,000 academic articles were published in 2020 alone to show for it. Data from the International Web of Science shows Iran was globally ranked as 16th in 2019 for its citation work. All things considered, Iran's tech ecosystem is flourishing. Several industries have benefited from indigenized technology that has facilitated big advancements productions.
Well, it is time for me to take a break while I pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
EPC is the alphabet of development in each country. It stands for engineering, procurement, and construction. Well, I'm here to spell it out by example. A case in point is this Iranian mega firm that has a long list of accomplishments in the EPC services, not only in Iran, but beyond. Let's take a tour around it.
Farah Tahriq Sepahan, shortly known as SBR, is a private EPC company that offers specialized consultations in a variety of fields, such as mining, steel, and environment. The company is based in Iran's central city of Isfahan. The company has under its belt a young but dedicated team of 200 experts who specialize in a range of fields, including civil engineering, electrical engineering, and mechanical engineering. Thanks to such a team, SBR says it has lived its big dreams.
Big names are known for their accomplishments, and SBR is no exception. Beside its long track record in different key industries, such as oil and gas, it has a lot to say when it comes to dolomite and lime kilns. When it comes to the domestic market, SBR is a household name now. But the ambitious company looks into farther perspectives and seeks to find a foothold in the global market.
SBR has so far worked with heavyweight EPC firms in the world, such as Mears, Danieli, Kutotech, Shizaki, and Ashton Balk, among others. But this is not where the ambitious company stops, as it tries to stand out on the global stage. With 25 years of experience, SBR says one of the secrets to its growth is its constant effort to keep abreast of the fast-growing technology.
SBR says its continued success over more than two decades of experience is built on one simple basis: passion for improvement, something which keeps the ambitious company on track toward even higher horizons.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Now it's time to dive right into some news and trends in Iran's high-tech industry to get more insight. The government has been implementing policies and measures to help support entrepreneurs develop their high-tech products. Now, this effort has paid off, as the patent office says it saw a rise in registrations of new inventions.
So far, 160 patents were registered on reputable international offices. That's according to the Patent Office of the Vice Presidency of Sciences and Technology. The National Patent Office says more than 2,100 inventors submitted their patent applications this year. Of this number, over 300 applications have been published in patent offices abroad.
More and more tech parks are sprouting up nationwide as Iran strengthens its tech ecosystem. And Kermanshah province has joined the efforts by launching a first-of-its-kind vertical tech park.
Most tech parks are spread across several hectares of land, but this one is a tower that reaches for the stars in Kermanshah city. The tower has a footprint of 20,000 square meters in 16 floors and is considered the largest tech tower in the country. Its sister tower will be constructed in the near future. The project is an innovation center that houses hundreds of incubators, startups, and other knowledge-based firms.
And last but not least, an Iranian knowledge-based firm builds a wearable robot that helps people with disabilities mobilize their legs.
The ExoPad exoskeleton is a robot fitted to the body and helps the user walk, sit, and stand up. The smart device is meant to replace the wheelchair, but it can also be used as a wheelchair too. The maker of the high-tech medical device offers it in two versions, which can be used in clinics as well as for personal daily mobility.
Well, that covers our program for today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program for humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful al-Imam Ali alayhi salamullah. We were looking at how Imam Ali alayhi salam were giving the rights and stating the rights of the family, beginning from marriage all the way to relatives. Now, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he tries to expand the chain and the link between the right of the family and even the right of the tribe itself. Now, we don't have tribes anymore. We don't live in tribes anymore. But we live in communities. We live in neighborhoods. So let's assume, let's use this as a metaphor to expand on our neighborhood at least, right? So Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he lays the foundation in trying to advise me and you. He says, well, expand your circle as much as you can to your relatives, be it close or be it far. If not, at least, this is me saying, at least let us expand on our neighborhood or the people that live near us, our neighbors. So in his will to his son, al-Imam al-Hasan alayhi as-salam, he says to him, O son, akrim ashiratak, be kind, be generous to your tribe. Why, ya Amir al-Mu'mineen? فَإِنَّهُمْ جَنَاحُكَ الَّذِي بِهِ تَطِيرُ. For they are the wings that you fly with. Meaning that without your tribe, without your relatives, without the people close to you giving you that support, you won't be able to do anything. So this is a metaphor. So he's using a metaphor to try to explain to us why is it important to have relatives around us. Because they are the wings of a bird. A bird without a wings cannot fly. Me by myself, I am weak. When I am with a unit, when I am with a group, I'm a lot stronger. I have something to rely on. I have someone to back me up. So then the Amir al-Mu'minin says to him, وَأَسْلُكَ الَّذِي إِلَيْهِ تَصِيرُ. And it is your root. Obviously, this is where you came from. You have to go back to your roots. Your family, your tribe is your root, right? وَيَدُكَ الَّتِي بِهَا تَصُولُ. And it is your hand that with which you do a lot of work. Also, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, using metaphor, trying to explain to us that in order for you to get a lot of things done, you would need the support of your household, you would need the support of your family, the support of your relatives, the support of your neighbors, the support of the area, or the people that you live around. So here, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi says, it's extremely vital that you keep the relationship and you keep that link. When a person decides to leave that circle, because sometimes, sadly, in our modern world, when you have family that sticks together and everything else, and this still exists in a lot of the Arabic countries, it's a point of pride, a point of strength. But sometimes you have these youth, especially these days, where they say, well, you know, they're still back. These guys are still backwards. They're still outdated. You know, I want to move to the city. I want to leave them alone. I want to do my own thing. Sure, by all means, you have the right. But then they do realize once they do that and they leave that pack and they are no longer with a group, they get to feel how hard it is to do things where you have no support, no one to rely on, and you could be easily broken by society itself when you are away from the flock, when you are away from the group. So Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah says, stay within that. Be generous to them, because you need them and because they are your support, because they are your backbone. Let us take a short break, then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to IRIB English Radio, to the program for humanity. We are talking about the rights, human rights, from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salamullah, he gives his son Imam Hassan an advice to be kind to his tribe. Then Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi moves a step further, and he tries to create a sense of unity within one tribe, one society, one neighborhood, you know, one family, what have you. So he tries to create that sense of respect within such a circle. And he says, especially when he talks about showing respect to the elders and showing mercy to the young ones. So you have three groups now. You have the elders, you have the young ones, and you have the group in the middle, the youth. Okay? The youth's job is to be kind to the elders and to be merciful and kind to the young ones. So he says, لِيَتَأَسَّ صَغِيرَكُمْ بِكَبِيرَكُمْ. Let your young use the old as a good example. وَلْيَرْفَأُوا كَبِيرَكُمْ بِصَغِيرَكُمْ. And let the grown-ups take care and be more generous to the young ones. وَلَا تَكُونُ كَجُفَاتُ الْجَاهِلِيَةِ. And don't be like the hardcore pagans, those who were so dry to the extent they used to humiliate and they used to cast away the elders, and at some point they were burying the girls alive. They were burying their children because of shame, because of poorness, or what have you. So he wants that as a way to create what? A sense of happiness, a sense of prosperity, a sense of respect within the community itself. If I am taking care of the elders, respecting the young, and the young get to see this action from me, obviously that will learn and that will pass on to generations to come. And if the elders as well have mercy towards the young ones, also you would have a strong sense of respect and happiness within the community. And we see like all these three groups play a major role. Sometimes now we see some of the elders, for example, who have money, have accumulated wealth, but they refuse to share it or to give it to those who are in need, at least from their own family. So you see, sometimes I've seen even this with families where the father or the mother, they have enough money, but the mother says, well, I'm not going to give it to my sons. They can go work for themselves. So she gives it to herself. The grandfather, for example, he has money, but he does not want to share it with his grandkids. Now, that's a problem. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given you something, and you lived a full life, it's time for you to help the young ones. When the young ones see, and they see such behavior from the elders, they themselves will adopt such a method, and that will create hate and animosity within the society, within the family, within the tribe. So Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he tries to point to all these things, and he puts his finger in all these sensitive cases, and he says they need to be looked at carefully. So I did not leave any stone unturned when it comes to human rights and the rights of the individual, the rights of the family, the rights of the tribe, the rights of the neighborhood, the rights of people, and everything else. We'll leave it here, and inshallah we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil'alamin, wa ala alin nabiyyi ajma'in, fabihim arjuka ahsin khatmina.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.